morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. The time is 7 minutes after 9 a.m., 29th of March, 2012. With me today is the co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, Senator McGuire, and myself, Stedman. We got one item up today. This morning is Senate Bill 192, Oil and Gas Production Tax, and we've asked for another presentation on progressivity with a little narrower scope so we can start zeroing in on refining the recommendations we'll make, or you guys will make to the chairman here so we can get it in the bill. With that, Mr. Janik Mayer with PFC Energy is going to walk us through his slides, and then we'll deal with the concerns or questions we have along the way. If you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then help us with this issue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Janik Mayer, manager in the upstream and gas practice at PFC Energy and project manager for this engagement we are undertaking for the Alaska State Legislature, assisting with analysis on fiscal terms reform. As the chairman says, the aim of this morning's presentation is to go over some of these issues of the base limit and progressivity with a narrower scope, looking in particular at the idea that's been floated in the last two sessions on taking progressivity out of the net production tax, having the net production tax be a flat 25% tax, and then levying progressivity instead in the form of a gross tax on oil that kicks in at a certain rate and increases in the same way as progressivity does under the current measure. Now, to recap the reasons for doing this, the existing fiscal structure presents some key difficulties in achieving the aims that the committee seems at the moment to be seeking, and there are two of those in particular. One is this question of the fact that with potential large-scale gas production in the future, if that gas production occurs at prices significantly below oil parity, as it's highly likely to, that creates a circumstance into which large volumes of gas at those low prices can substantially reduce overall production tax value in the ACES system, meaning that the large-scale gas production essentially reduces taxes that are otherwise paid on oil production. CSSB 192, of course, attempts to deal with this issue by separately accounting for oil and for gas, and requires, therefore, a mechanism to be able to split out costs in accounting between oil versus gas. And as we've discussed, this is a significant administrative burden, not only on companies, but also in terms of the capacity of the state to actually administer such a system. Secondly, under the existing system, options for incentivizing new production are quite limited because there are one or two things that can be done, and those are encompassed in the bills that we've looked at in terms of having a particular dollar value allowance against production tax value or a tax holiday, for instance, on a certain portion of revenue. The impact of most of those, as we've seen, is by and large relatively limited, and they're also quite complicated both to put into legislative language, to understand, to model. As an alternative framework set out to overcome those two issues, this concept of a progressive severance tax option instead is one, as I say, in which progressivity would be removed from the base production tax, the net tax, and instead that tax would be levied at a flat base rate of 25%. Then to retain that element of progressivity, this new progressive severance tax, a gross tax, would be added to the system. The tax would be non-deductible for profit-based production tax purposes. And some of the analysis that was presented in the previous sessions, in fact, showed what it would be like when it was deductible. But it, in many ways, both for the sake of simplicity of the system and its calculations, and also from the perspective of if the aim is actually to retain some degree of progressivity, in many ways, having it be deductible for the purposes of production tax actually undermines that aim because, of course, with each increment of progressivity, there's a partial offset in the form of reduced production tax, and so the overall progressivity is actually smaller than it might be otherwise. So which is why what we've modeled here is one which is non-deductible for profit-based production tax purposes. It's one that's levied solely on gross production of and solely on oil. So in that sense, already the decoupling issue goes away because oil and gas together on a BTU equivalent basis, exactly the same way as they are under ACEs, are being taxed by the production tax. But instead of there being a variable rate that's applied, there's that flat 25% rate. So what the cost of gas is versus what the cost of oil is no longer matters because everything's once again being taxed at 25% rate. And so we deal with that decoupling issue without all of the question of having to have separate accounting of costs for oil and gas, the ability of companies to report that, to lodge essentially separate tax returns for those things, and also the ability of the state to be able to audit those things and confirm that they are actually accurate splits of the costs. Now, the progressive severance tax modeled here is one that uses a progressivity structure not dissimilar to that under the current system. So there are progressivity coefficients that apply at different thresholds. That which has been modeled here, based on the wishes of the committee and the chairman, has sort of spelled out over the last couple of sessions to have a system that keeps revenue fairly close, for instance, to CSSB 192 at the $100 level and even a little above, but that starts to diverge significantly from there, that flattens out the split between companies and the state after that point. To do that, what's been used here is a base rate for the progressive severance tax of zero, progressivity of 0.25%, and again, this is on a net basis, so it's not comparable to the 0.4 that one sees in ACEs, which is, of course, so it's on a gross basis, not comparable to the 0.4 that one sees on a net basis in ACEs. Progressivity of 0.25 commencing at a threshold of $65, and that's gross value at point of production. Then at $125 gross value point of production, we reach a level of 15% by that progressivity amount. And at this point, progressivity is then reduced to 0.05% and continues up for a way and then is capped at 20% for the progressive severance tax. So as I say, by doing this, we remove the question of having to account separately between oil and gas production. And in addition to that, we also then have the ability to provide significant incentives for new production, for instance, by eliminating entirely the progressive severance tax for particular forms of new production or by reducing it by certain amounts. And one can do any of those things either for an indefinite period, for a particular period of time. All of those things can now come into play because to do any of these things, we only need two pieces of information: what's a particular production stream and what's the oil price. We no longer need to understand, and the third part, the really complicated part, what are the costs that go along with that production stream. So what that means is this is a structure that enables those two big issues that the committee is grappling with to be addressed in a range of different ways, and that can really provide a framework to achieve quite a wide range of levels of government take, depending on the particular parameters that are used in the model. As I say, the parameters that we've used here are those aimed at having roughly similar revenue to the state at $100 to CSSB 192, and at levels more like where we are today, an evening of the split between companies and the state. So if we look on an FY13 basis at what that actually looks like, we have here for a range of crude prices from $10 increments from 40 to 150, what that looks like in terms of levels of production tax for the three options: total state take, total government take, and then cash to companies. So if we focus on that $100 level, under ACEs at that level, we had total revenues of about $3.7 billion. Under CSSB 192, that's reduced to about a little over $3.5 billion. This reduces it just a little further, It's very difficult to nail that figure exactly, and of course there is significant margin of error in doing any analysis like this at the purely macro level. Start taking financial year 2013 numbers and applying the cost structure to that as a whole, as opposed to what would be a much, much more difficult task, which would be understanding asset by asset what does it actually look like. So given that margin of error that's involved in this, without getting some particularly sort of peculiar and very non-round figures, it's difficult to get much, much closer than that, particularly if one also wants to err on the side of caution, which is not wanting to jack up taxation significantly below the $100 level. But this structure seems to get quite close, as we'll see on some of the following graphs, on some of the following slides. But then from that level on, we get a greater divergence, particularly as we get past the $130 level, as the government take under the progressive severance tax flattens out and has a more even split, whereas progressivity under both ACES and CSS 192 continues to escalate and take more and more for the state. To see what those numbers look like,
Let's stay on this page a little bit, because there's a lot of information on here, and it's the committee hasn't had time to preview these charts because they just came fresh off the printer this morning as we worked through the system. Mr. Mayor has been running these hypotheticals and changing some of the variables, working these numbers, so it's kind of a process underway in action. So on the FY13 expectations at $100 a barrel, and again, there's been testimony here at the committee that at $100 a barrel, it seems to be within range of reasonableness to function, but north of that, it becomes problematic for tax structure. So that's why we're zeroing in on this $100 range. So the government take numbers at $100, and again, for those watching at home, that would include our property tax, all the severance tax, income tax, royalties, both into the permanent fund and not. We're fairly close. We're within like $70 million at $100. Am I reading that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And then, excuse me, I was off one line. That was the previous line. A little more than that, 130 million. Pretty close at $90 a barrel, and pretty close at 80. And then down at, can you address the $40 and $50 range, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. So one sees in the $40 and $50 range, this option is identical to CSSB 192 as it currently stands at that range. The reason, of course, being that at those prices, and indeed at all prices below $65, there is no difference between them, because progressivity in both cases has yet to kick in under either. As at oil prices of, if we, so in that sense, at the $60 range, revenue is identical for all three. At the $40 and $50 range, CSSB 192, both as it is and with the alternative of progressive severance, those two are the same, but they are higher than ACES at those levels, and that, of course, is the function of the 10% of gross value of production being set as a minimum floor for the production tax that is entailed in CSSB 192. So that's the reason for that difference.
And then this 13 revenue off of the revenue source book projections is the homogenized numerics. So we've got firms in there that have no production that are absorbing about $400 million in credits impacting these numbers. So we need to have Mr. Mayor, come back, run these tables under the with the trying, if we can get a snapshot of current producers in FY13, if possible, so we can kind of parse that out. Because I know we've looked in the past where those numbers have moved. When we go from the homogenized, what we've been calling the homogenized numbers, to actually looking at just the firms that are that have production, and measure that, see if we can't get a feel for how the numbers move in that realm. Have you had a chance to look at that yet?
I haven't, Mr. Chairman. I can certainly look to see if additional analysis on that front is, right, is possible.
Okay, that's fair enough, because we're he was up late last night and early this morning just cranking this stuff out. So there's more to do, but I want to keep the committee kind of informed as we work through this process and as we try to adjust these numerics. Senator Hoffman.
So what we're projecting today, which is $109, about $110, between $8,549 under ACES down to $8,215, that would be a third of $1 billion in reduction to the state's revenue. But when you look at the total number that the companies would receive in cash would be substantially higher than that. That would be, or would that be lower than that? They would get what, 220?
Yeah, 217.
217.
So that would be at $110.
Which we are today, which we're projecting in the revenue estimates today.
Correct. For FY13.
And through the chair, Senator Hoffman, you're pointing out that the additional cash received by companies is lower than the reduction in take to the state. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that's the function, of course, of some of that gap being taken up by increased take to the federal government,
which we have no control over.
Through the chair, indeed, Senator Lesno.
What are futures selling for today?
Pardon me?
What are futures selling for today? Do we have an idea?
200.
200? I think they're at 200. So we don't go to 200, but if we looked at futures, it would even be more substantial, a reduction to the state and to the oil companies. So I think we need to look at where futures are today, because I think that was the mistake that many individuals made when we were doing ACES. We were looking at the $40 to $70 range, but futures were way above that, and that's where the oil prices went.
So if I could just recap what Senator Hoffman is pointing out, 2010, the state take numbers, and again, this is all in, so it's going to look different when we just look at the producing companies. We'd expect a movement in the Treasury to the negative side of $334 million.
Third of a billion, then.
And then the industry to pick up $217 million of that. But those numbers are going to be somewhat moved when we try to parse out the non-producers, which we need to do.
And, Mr. Chairman, we need to look at what futures are and what the take would be under those scenarios, because I think Senator Thomas is right. The futures are selling today at probably around 200.
If I could just try to point out, I think the current numbers in front of you, roughly at $130 and north, the split, or maybe it's 125, somewhere in there on these numbers, this percentage split between the industry and the state should remain constant. Fairly close. Is that correct, Mr. Mayor? And you want to explain to us how that works?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. If we turn briefly to the following slide, it may be easier to illustrate. If we look at the top left, where this is clearest, which is in revenue from the production tax, including the progressive severance tax, what we see, of course, is at around $100, very little difference between the three options here. A slightly increasing divergence to about 120, 130, and at that point, which of course is where 125, with the difference of transportation costs being where the inflection point of the dramatically reduced progressivity under the progressive severance tax occurs, that's essentially where you see that flattening out. And so the idea of that very minimal 0.05% progressivity that then occurs above that level, above the $125 gross value level, is that it's just enough to offset at those price levels, very slightly regressive nature of the royalty as the royalty continues to decline as a share of government take, and basically hold government take almost completely flat from that point onward.
But, Mr. Chairman, it could be looked at another way, and that is as you compare the numbers as you go north of 130 to 200 under ACES, the state's split continues to decline, and the amount of cash to the companies continues to increase. In comparing ACES to the current bill being proposed.
Right, the current under ACES, the percent.
As you compare ACES to 192 with progressive severance tax option, our share will continue to decline as compared to ACES north of 130, and the oil company's share will continue to rise.
Yes.
That's the way I look at it, Mr. Chairman.
That is correct. That's another way of looking at it. So the percentage of the pie should stay the same. Currently, the percentage of the pie shrinks to the industry under ACES, even though their dollars increase. The state's percent of the pie continues to get larger under ACES, and our revenue stream, grows rapidly. Under this proposal, north of basically 130, that percentage sharing would stay constant.
But the comparison between ACES.
Right, but when you compare to ACES, you start seeing substantial. If we measured, and we can go measure the $200 range, we can have them calculate that and actually put that in dollar terms. But you got to remember it, to get to $200, the costs would move because we're under a net system. So you can just kind of, I think if we were at 200 for very long, we'd have an incremental rise in costs, which would pull that down a little bit. But the idea here is to try to stabilize that sharing relationship between the industry and the state at some point, but not put the state in a position where we go into a regressive environment. In other words, where our percent of the pie shrinks. I don't think they like that any more than we like it, so.
And, Mr. Chairman, that was one of the primary concerns that the industry had, was that there was no advantage for development because they kept on losing share at the high end, and that high end needed to be addressed, and I think this does address it.
You want to walk through these four quadrants on the slide six and tell us what you've tried to depict here?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. So in the top left, what we have is revenue from the production tax, including in the case of the progressive severance tax, the severance. And the red line, of course, being ACES, the yellow being CSSP 192, and the blue being 192 with the progressive severance tax alternative. In the bottom right, we have sort of, in many ways, the mirror of that, which is what does cash to companies look like in those three different cases. And, of course, in the same way as we see revenue from production tax diverging from severance and evening out, but being, as Senator Hoffman points out, a reduction at those price levels over ACEs. We see the same at those higher price levels where there is greater cash to companies at those higher price levels, but at the $100 and below mark, a very similar result. Of course, in both cases, what we see is that, once again, 192 and 192 with progressive severance tax at very low price levels result in reduced cash to companies and increased take to the state as a function of the 10% of gross value production tax floor that is in 192. Finally, the bottom left and the top right are simply showing what total state take and total government take looks like in those scenarios. And, of course, because there are other elements of those things, the gap between the options looks significantly smaller.
So maybe we can have some of these take numbers put in percentage terms when we parse out the producing numerics and then the non-producers. Because I think that what we're going to find is when we run these analysis on the homogenized entire revenue stream to the state, the industry runs it on their own numbers, which we don't know what they are, but they don't match up. And the reason is, one of the reasons is we have the impact of the non-producers' credits swinging into our treasury at $400 million and a few other things moving the numbers. So we need to get a feel for that.
So, Mr. Chairman, to move on to the question.
And on that, yesterday or the day before we had numbers looking at what happened at $200 a barrel, and if futures are at $200 a barrel, it would be nice to look at those charts as graphs at 200 as well, because I think you're going to see that the numbers probably be north of $1 billion in difference.
We can have PFC run those. I asked them actually to bring in the x-axis to 150, because their lines are going to run parallel north of 125, 130, so you can extrapolate out. But we can redo them to 200, so you can see that. But I thought if we, you know, as we stretch out, we've had some charts here that go quite a bit north of $200, and it's kind of a distraction to look at like 230 when we're at $120 barrel oil.
So but if futures are selling at 200, we should at least look at that.
Oh yeah, no, we'll look at that. So we'll have those charts produced for the committee.
Ms. Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I can certainly look into the question of what both ANS West Coast and crude oil futures in general are trading at. Given that we have spot prices at the moment of around the $120 mark, I would be very surprised to see futures dramatically above that and to the level to the price level you suggest. But I will look into that if I may and get back to you.
Thank you.
Well, we'll go on and talk about incentives for new production, which is one of the other challenge areas.
As I commenced the presentation by talking about, Mr. Chairman, one of the benefits of this structure, whatever the numbers that one plugs into it, is not only that it overcomes the decoupling issue without requiring that complex issue of accounting for costs, but it also creates a number of ways in which one can provide significant incentives for new production. One could, as I say, either reduce the progressive severance tax significantly for particular new production streams. One could eliminate it entirely. One could do that for different periods of time or do that indefinitely. All those things become options precisely because one no longer has to look at the question of which costs came with particular production, but just has to be able to know production numbers associated with that production stream and then look at the crude oil price. Here, what's been modelled is a lower, reduced rate of progressive severance tax for new production, with a base rate of zero again, progressivity of essentially the lowest coefficient that for existing production is applied above the $125 mark, here applied as the only coefficient, so 0.05%, commencing at that same threshold of $65, but capped at a maximum of 5%. And we can look at what this looks like for our sort of stylized version of a high-cost 10,000 barrel a day new development, both under the regular rate as modeled so far, this reduced rate when applied with a time limit of 7 years, and then what it would look like with no time limit at all. So to begin with,
can we go back a slide? Yeah. And maybe I didn't hear you, but address the bottom of the slide. High cost portion on your slide here, the third bullet.
So the coming slides are looking at, based on a stylized, the same sort of stylized 10,000 barrel a day high cost development that we've used in some of the previous analysis presented before the committee, using that as a benchmark to say, well, what do levels of government take, and what for this sort of hypothetical high cost field do project economics look like in each of these three scenarios? So for that development, applying the 20% maximum standard of the severance tax, what we see here is levels of government take that essentially from $100 or so onwards are relatively steady around the 76-75% mark, a little bit of regressivity when we look at it in this case, as opposed to when we look at it for an existing producer or for the base production, where it's more perfectly steady. And again, this is a particularly high cost field, and with capital and production profile structured in a way that means it really only breaks even somewhere a little to the south of $100 crude oil. So in this case, we have negative net present value, and the $60 and $40 oil cases. And positive net present value only in the $100 case, and at that level it's enough to achieve an internal rate of return of only about 11%, so really very marginal even at $100 oil.
And then can you talk a little bit about the expenses you're using here, your CapEx? And
These are based on CapEx and OpEx figures essentially of about $17 a barrel. That OPEX figure in particular, I think, is really quite reflective of some of the higher cost new developments we've seen in recent years, particularly when one, for instance, for some of the new producers that have to share facilities, incorporate some of the things like the implicit costs in their back-out agreements. And similarly, that the high level of CAPEX is reflective of the significant increases we've seen in capital costs for new developments, particularly in cases where there isn't a lot of existing infrastructure. And that's for a light oil field. We see capital and operating costs that go significantly above that, for instance, for some of the viscous projects that are proposed, at least in terms of company estimates.
And then just, I know there's probably some people watching that haven't seen these charts before, so we need to take just a moment and walk through these four quadrants, even though some of it's repetitive, but you'll probably be doing this a couple more times before we're done, so you'll have the drill down here shortly.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. So the top left, we what we have is just a basic cash flow diagram. We have capital spending in the yellow as negative cash flow in the early years, followed by production giving positive revenue over time with declining production. That curve that one sees from in the blue of revenue that comes from production, the actual decline curve of production itself is steeper than that. That's of course being partly offset by the impact of inflation, giving higher nominal cash flows in 4 years, even as production itself declines. And then operating costs in the red that go along with that, and the black line being the after-tax cash flow then produced by the combination of these things. In the early years, what we see, of course, is after-tax cash flow that's not as strongly negative as the yellow of the CapEx is, and that is the impact of the 20% capital credit. In the blue table next to that chart, we have those basic economic metrics of net present value and internal rate of return for this stylized project at those prices. In the table on the right, we have total levels of government take, total levels of state take at each of those range of prices we've been looking at. For each element of take, what's calculated there is what that looks like when, for instance, we take royalty or severance tax or production tax and look at it as a portion of divisible income. So those percentages add horizontally to total stake or total government take. We then see those total state and total government take figures in the bottom two charts, both in absolute dollar terms for this particular development and what it looks like in overall percentage terms on the bottom right.
Okay.
To move on from the case in which the full 20% maximum is applied, if we instead apply that discounted rate with the maximum of 5%, but that 5% applied only for the first 7 years and then reverting to the 20% maximum, what we see is an increase, of course, in the cash flows in those first 7 years of production, and then after that, an identical cash flow. What that does, if we compare the two, is, of course, in our $40 and $60 cases, the economics are identical because below that point, the progressive severance tax does not apply at all. But above that level, our net present value for the project has climbed fairly moderately, at least, from $29 to $77 million, which gives us a percentage point increase in the internal rate of return from 11% to 12%. And what we see is a further reduction in government take, particularly at the higher levels. So we peak at around 73%. In fact, then it comes down very slightly from that point onward.
Senator Hoffman.
With this, could it be viewed that the maximum in the first 7 years at 5% be considered a tax holiday?
It's certainly a... Senator Hoffman, through the chair, it's certainly a tax reduction. Not a holiday entirely, as far as every barrel is still taxed, but it's taxed at a lower rate for those first 7 years.
A reduced tax holiday.
Reduced tax holiday.
If we then turn to the next slide, we see what that would look like if it were not a 7 year limit, but simply that 5% maximum. Of course, for the first 7 years, our cash flows are identical, but the cash flow tail then increases significantly as well as that reduced tax level is applied across the board. And our NPV then, of course, rises further from the previous 77 to 119, and again another percentage point is added to the internal rate of return for this stylized project. And what we then see is a sort of flattening out of government take, really from the $70 range upward, and about a 65% government take figure applied, looking across the life cycle for the project as a whole.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, I will move on to the next slide, slide 11. Which then looks at the question of what's the potential impact over a 20-year time horizon of offering such a benefit for new production. Now, as we've talked about before, there are a number of ways in which one might identify new production. The simplest way is... the very simplest way is, of course, to provide an incentive for production from new areas. That is... the incentive, the way, for instance, the incentive for new oil that's under HB 110 works. But, of course, the problem with just applying things on that basis is most new production that we expect to see is going to come from within existing areas, not from entirely new areas. The second option is to try to apply that benefit for new production through the regulatory process. So, for instance, when new plans of development are lodged, providing some sort of authority to the executive so that they can approve particular new plans of development as indeed providing new production and allow that lower rate of taxation to be applied to those new projects at that point. With both of those two options, it's also then relatively easy to apply a time limit, whether that be 7 years, 10 years, 15 years, however long one might want to do it. If one wants to apply a time limit to that reduced rate, precisely because with both of those options there is a clear initial start of production, one can then say, okay, 7 years from that, 10 years, 15, whenever, is when that benefit stops and the higher rate applies. The third option that one might take, which is to say, particularly for existing producers, if what one wants to incentivize is production above the sort of 6% decline level that we've talked a lot about, would be to set that decline level essentially in stone at this point in time and project that curve forward and see what that curve looks like and say, okay, production above that will have this preferential rate of taxation applied to it. If one does that, it's no longer really possible to then apply a particular time-limited window to that because there's no longer a question of a particular stream of production that started at a particular date that we can then say, okay, 7 years on, this is when that stops. So, for instance, if one did want to apply a limit, for instance, to the other two, and one wanted to equalize, relatively speaking, the impact of the benefit for new production, one might then want a slightly different gradient to be applied to the new production above the 6% base, so that over time the benefit of those two options were more equal. If one doesn't apply a time limit at all, then one doesn't need to differentiate on that basis. Here, in this slide, what I've done is to try to say, well, to get at least an initial figure of what that might imply in terms of the 20-year impact of such policy. Now, the 2013 impact is next to nothing because there will be very little production by these definitions in the next financial year if this were enacted this year that counts as new production. But if we say, if we think that over time this might have an increasing impact, what might that look like in terms of the 20-year revenue impact? So what I've done here is taken Department of Revenue 20-year production figures, so out to 2032, along with their cost forecasts that run to about 2021, and then escalated those at a small amount moving forward from there.
If you could just stop there. I don't know if registered much, but the cost numbers that we were looking at run out to 2021? We haven't seen those at this table before that I'm aware of. We saw them till, I think, 16? Apparently these numbers run a lot further out in time than we've had the ability to look at. That's probably a point of discussion at some point, but we'll get copies of that document to the committee members. Go ahead and continue.
So using that production profile and that those cost estimates, one can then model out the cash flow with under a range of scenarios. Here what we've done is we've then said, okay, to get a rough estimate based on that DOR forecast of new production, which includes a range of things, production from projects that are currently in development, what they anticipate at the moment for planned new development, and say if we simply took that 6% curve and drew that line down today, by applying that differential between the old production and the new production over the course of 20 years, what would be the difference in the net present value of those cash flows of applying the 20% rate, maximum rate, to all of them versus applying the 5% maximum rate on an indefinite basis to all of the production above that 6% decline. And so here we see, for instance, at the $100 level, there's about a $10 billion difference in the net present value of cash flows over that 20-year period for the production tax. So from around $40 billion to around $30 billion in the present value of the 20-year cash flows, when everything above a 6% decline, for instance, is taxed at the lower rate. Now, my intention in doing this analysis isn't to suggest that this is how this would actually work in practice, because obviously significant parts of this production are in fact new projects, and relatively little probably is increased production from existing fields. So the idea isn't that this sort of 6% decline curve would actually in practice be applied in this way. It's simply a way of trying to get particularly a lower limit on, given this forecast of what might be produced over the next 20 years, what a lower limit on how big could, in theory, the potential difference be by applying that preferential rate.
One of the concerns I had when I was talking with Mr. Mayor is that when we, in concept, when we come up with a process or an adjustment for incremental production, that we don't put the state in a position where several years out we've walked down some curve and we have no revenue. You know, the deal looks good today and, you know, it does you in tomorrow. So a little bit cautious as far as how we transition into the new production area and still make sure the state is treated fairly in the process and the industry for that matter.
Finally, Mr. Chairman, to come back to that question of benchmarking competitiveness against a range of other regimes, particularly in yellow relevant OECD regimes, what we see is that, as we say, for an existing producer under ACES, we're at $100 a barrel, just a little less than Norway, the highest taxing OECD producer. And of course, as we've seen before, if one increases that to 150, actually we're significantly above Norway for an existing producer. If we look at where CSSB 192 sits, it's just a very slight reduction in government take, of course, because a number of these jurisdictions are quite closely clustered together. At that point, we notionally see a reduction in two places and an increase in two places in competitiveness, but in reality, we're talking really a single percentage point of difference between those two in terms of what that does to government take. If we look, though, at severance tax option for CSSB 192, what that does is it takes us from a government take at those levels of, I think, around 73-74%, and takes us down to just above 70%. If we look at, on the following slide, and the final slide, at what that looks like in the case of a new development, we've talked before about the fact that under ACES, levels of government take can frequently be higher for new developments, in part because of their higher cost structure and in part because of the fact that if one is putting together an entirely new development without an existing base production portfolio, one doesn't have as much benefit from... one gets the same 20% capital credit, one can get a net operating loss credit of 25%, but one doesn't get as much benefit of the ability to fully write down all of one's existing expenditure on current production that may be taxed at above the 25% level. So that's the reason why government take for new development is higher than it is on the previous slide for an existing development, and indeed in this case is above Norway at that level. If we compare that, however, to, for instance, then the severance tax with the 5% maximum applied for 7 years, that takes us down significantly, though still in the realm of some of the higher taxing jurisdictions around. If we do that and apply it not just for 7 years but extend it indefinitely, that actually then takes us down to a level that's really quite competitive, for instance, with some of the higher levels that we see for So the higher cost developments, particularly the unconventional developments that we see in places like Louisiana and Texas.
So why would we want to be below them? Louisiana and Eagle Ford in Texas.
One thing to bear in mind, Mr. Chairman, you'll note, for instance, on this chart that those are broken out as different from conventionals for Louisiana and Texas. The reason there is a difference in government take for those two is not that there is some different regime that applies to those, but that costs, relatively speaking, for unconventionals are higher than they are for regular onshore drilling, which leads to higher government take. But even at those higher costs for those unconventionals remain below what we see for costs here on the North Slope. So government take is one part of the metric, but another part of the side of things that makes some of these things economic is a question of what are the costs associated. So in that sense, just because one is competitive on government take doesn't mean one is as attractive an investment destination for investment.
So and then this concept of the, going down, taking your variable severance tax with a 5% maximum out for 7 years, and as we change those numerics, maybe stretch it in time or move that maximum a little bit, we can actually slide down to the point where we take it away and we're at where you depict in the chart at the 5% maximum, so we can move it within that range?
But by changing that period from 7 years to a greater period, yes, one can move that bar within that range.
And then we could potentially in the future then target it to different hydrocarbons?
Certainly one could do that. Indeed, part of the benefit of, again, taking progressivity out of the production tax and putting it in this component is, once again, one doesn't need to know anything about that question of costs. All one needs to know is the production volumes associated with it with a given production stream and an oil price. So it makes all those things possible. Of course, if there are particularly challenged hydrocarbon types, for instance, perhaps in the future heavy oil, one thing what one might want to look at, if for instance one were to decide there were greater incentive needed to develop some of that than even the flat 25% production tax by itself, one alternative, although I realize one that might seem more controversial, would be in fact to take production tax for everything from that 25 rate and reduce it further, say for instance to 20, and then for existing production make that up by raising the progressive severance tax further, so that so that overall take for existing production remained around the same, but it would mean that you could then provide even further additional incentive for particularly challenged development if that were desirable.
Right. Just depending on what lever we want to push and pull.
Indeed.
We have other questions or things you'd like BFC to run? I'm going to have Senator McGuire and then Senator Thomas.
Thank you. Through the chair, I assume you're preparing to do this, but for the regime competitiveness slides, they're great. Could you run them at 140, 150, 160 a barrel?
Certainly, Senator McGuire.
Well, it might be easier if we just did $20 increments, 80, 100, 120, 140, 160, okay, something like that, because it should be a kind of a linear relationship as once we get rolling.
And if Senator Hoffman wants it to go up to 200, I don't know.
And we could run one at 200 if you wanted. It's just a variable. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just looking at the regime competitiveness, and I don't know how you ever actually figure that out. So many variables that come into play, and I just looking at it, to me, the first four people on the list, I don't know how much investment is actually taking place in those countries, but the first four that are on the list, I know that I wouldn't care to do any business there, and there's several others above us, and then some in between the different variations that we've looked at today, and this is probably not a question or a statement unless you feel that there is some validity to trying to look at the amount of investment that takes place in some of those countries. We're we're below, just like, what did I say? I don't have my glasses on today, but Venezuela, you know, a country that kicked, you know, nationalized the oil fields and kicked the people out of there. So there are a wide variety of countries I don't think we'd even want to be doing business with if I was an oil company and someone that have even commented that. And then I look at some of the others that we're trying to potentially be more competitive with, say, in the United States, and I don't think we'll ever be directly competitive with them based on the cost of doing business in those areas versus the cost of doing business on the North Slope of Alaska. So I'm struggling with the concept of how you actually arrive at what is competitive other than just saying strict dollars.
And if I could add a little bit, just on the bottom side of that chart, we have Ireland with no oil. I mean, quite frankly, I don't think they have much oil, even though their government take numbers are, you know, the lowest. Greenland is another one that's in the same area. Numbers look attractive, but the prospectivity is pretty low. If you can help us with that, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Chairman, certainly. The point, both you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Thomas raise are entirely valid points. At the higher level of the scale, we do indeed see countries that, for a range of reasons, including their government take, may well be significantly less attractive destinations for investment. On the other hand, one point to bear in mind in that sense is, again, government take is only one important variable in the question of competitiveness and desirability of a destination for investment. So some jurisdictions, for instance, though they may, for instance, have greater political risk, though they may have higher government take, may have resources, for instance, that can be developed with very minimal cost, and therefore in certain circumstances maybe remain attractive for certain projects despite high levels of government take. Similarly, indeed, when we look at an island or New Zealand, yes, they're very attractive from a fiscal regime perspective, but not significant resources to be tapped there. Again, when we come to comparing Alaska, for instance, to the lower 48, we do see that we have higher government take here. But again, we have that question of costs, and particularly for onshore, conventional onshore production, costs here much, much higher than we see in the lower 48. And so in that sense, the competitiveness difference actually is compounding, because it's not just a question of higher government take, but also higher costs. So all of these things need to be considered in thinking about these things. This is simply one way of taking one particular metric, which we've been relatively focused on in this discussion, which is the government take, and seeing, forgetting the other parts of things that determine competitiveness, where do we stand on that basis?
Follow up, and then Senator Hoffman.
Just and also the production per well is another important aspect of it. Do you not agree?
Absolutely, Senator Thomas.
Thank you,
Senator Hoffman.
Brief at ease.
Record, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I read the newspaper this morning, there was an article in there quoting the governor on commitments from industry, saying that he would veto legislation if they didn't have commitments. And I don't really remember seeing commitments from the industry in 110, and I was wondering if you, as the chairman, have received any communications from the governor regarding that topic or any proposed ideas of commitments.
No. All I've heard is what I read in the newspaper. But I do recollect Ugarit and Nikaichuk was referenced, as I recall, by Exxon's testimony, that that's what we'd need in comparison every year to flatten out our oil decline, which is 3 to 5 billion a year, not 5 billion over 8 or 10 years. So the scale of magnitude that's discussed and commented in the press and the magnitude that we actually need, they're not even comparable. So at this table, we're looking at 3 to 5 billion a year additional, if in fact it's the Ugarit and Nikaichuk in magnitude that we need. So the expectations of advancing north to 600,000 barrels a day in state lands, I think, is problematic. But I'm open to ideas how to get there. We have any other questions? There was a question from one of the committee members here, Iraq. I was just kind of curious. One of them noticed that Iraq didn't appear to be on the screen on your ranking, and I know at some point you have to, you know, limit some in, some out. But I was wondering if you had any comments on where Iraq would be. I think they actually have service contracts where they're paid per barrel, and nobody's suggesting we do that, so don't have anybody's imagination run wild here. But it's a different methodology.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Suddenly, Iraq is a relatively high government take regime, and that is particularly because, as you say, the fiscal structure there for new developments involving international companies is a service contract one, where a number of points are negotiated as part of the awarding of the contract. But among those is a question of existing levels of production and some sort of plateau from that, and then providing essentially payments for production that is able to occur over and above that plateau level, but really very little for anything below that. So it's specifically a way of saying these are our existing producing assets that we own and run, but that we can't produce much more than this out of for international companies that come here. If you're able to come and produce significantly more out of these than we are, then you'll be paid for that, but not for anything else.
Yeah. Any other questions for Mr. Mayor before he retreats back to his office to crank out more data for us? Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a question, but I just want to say thank you to Mr. Janik for all of his hard work. I know he arrived here jet-lagged, and you put him right to work, and appreciate the work that you're doing for our state and for this committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator McGuire. Okay.
With that, that'll conclude this morning's meeting. Next meeting will be 1 p.m. today. We're going to have three bills, Senate Bill 25, ADA, Sustainable Energy Program, House Bill 250, Extend Renewable Energy Grant Fund, and Senate Bill 182, People Transportation Funding. We're adjourned.